This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Today on the Compass, we talk with a couple who have just returned from the front lines in the latest battle of the Sioux tribe to maintain control of their treaty lands, which turns out also to be a battle against climate disruption and ecological devastation. And then we take note of the historical openings of two new local institutions. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Armed white men stand off against police in Oregon, acquitted, unarmed water protectors in North Dakota, concussion grenades, rubber bullets, and batons were used against them. FAA made a no-fly zone, yet DAPL private security planes or choppers were flying very low all day long, like way below, you know, what's legal. North Dakota police have been saying we are armed vigilance. The only weapons on site yesterday were in the hands of the militarized police, which included assault rifles, snipers, concussion grenades, batons, tasers, pepper spray, etc. Horseback riders were attacked by police on ATVs, resulting in one horse being hurt so severely that it had to be put down. And they shot when there were three youth riders on these horses. When they were shot at, not with rubber bullets. This was live ammo.
The speaker was Lois Barnett, the volunteer administrator of the Pacific Northwest Standing Rock Support Facebook page, who was reporting to a group of about 30 local activists gathered last Friday evening at the Rosewind Commons House to plan further local support for the movement to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, commonly known by the acronym DAPL, across unceded treaty lands of the Lakota Sioux Nation in North Dakota. Just the day before, a militarized police force of more than 300 officers in riot gear had descended upon one recently erected camp set up on contested ground directly in the oil pipeline's path, and using helicopters, Humvees, ATVs, mace, concussion grenades, rubber bullets, and even some live ammunition, forcefully removed the peaceful water protectors, as they call themselves, in some cases pulling people out of prayer circles and sweat lodges, throwing them to the ground, and arresting them. The campers call themselves water protectors because the pipeline, if and when finally constructed, will cross both the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. A rupture at either of those junctions would have devastating and long-lasting environmental consequences affecting millions downstream. And such a rupture, they point out, is almost inevitable over the life of such a pipeline. In the 7 months since the first Standing Rock camp was established on private land owned by LaDonna Brave Bull Allard near the oil pipeline's proposed path, many thousands of supporters from around the world, including those from some 300 Native nations, have come to join the cause of stopping a pipeline that, when linked with others, would provide the pathway for Canadian tar sands oil to the sea that seemed blocked when President Obama refused permission for the building of the hotly contested Keystone Pipeline. Hundreds have been arrested for acts of civil disobedience, such as chaining themselves to bulldozers. The sentences for such acts have been increasingly harsh, with second arrests for returning to the fray treated as felonies, according to reliable sources. Among the supporters has been a sizable contingent from eastern Jefferson County, including several locals who have made multiple trips out to Standing Rock. Among those are Gary Buckman, a full-blooded Lakota Sioux, and his wife Hannah Reese, who recently returned from a 2-week visit to the Standing Rock encampment. I interviewed Buckman and Reese in their tiny shop, the Big Wolf Trading Company, across Taylor Street from the Rose Theater a few days before the forceful eviction of the blockade campers. Buckman sees the battle against the pipeline as just a continuation of a much older battle.
I am Oglala Lakota Sichangu from Chunkpe Upi, which means Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Oglala is the Pine Ridge side. I have relatives in Rosebud, which is the Sichanghu side. My mother's knife, who are Yojaja Oyate, from Kyle, South Dakota. So my family goes on my mother's side. We have relatives in Canada all the way down, and specifically in Standing Rock also. The family, when Sitting Bull's people went up back and forth, various camps stayed in here and there. And so, it's a generational issue, you know, for my people. You know, we've been at this since first contact was around 1700-something. So ever since then, we've been dealing with various issues, you know. Now, it's more of a global issue because, as usual, most Native people around the world get the short end of the stick when there's some kind of so-called economic development project, you know. We get our lands flooded when they build a dam, you know. We lose our forest or our traditional hunting grounds when they make it into something else, you know, supposedly for the good of the people. But again, they reject the idea of the indigenous people having any kind of rights to claim, you know. So when we talk about the military-industrial complex, you know, that's something that we know very well. You know, when we first were dealt with, we were dealt with the Department of Army. And when they put us on reservations, those were originally run by the Department of the Army, which, you know, evolved later into the Indian Services, which turned into the BIA, you know. And so we've dealt with the military-industrial complex all these times, you know. All of our lands that we ceded were or taken from us. It's just another example of how we've been treated historically by this whatever administration or power is in charge. You know, our wishes or our needs or our, as Native people, are always secondary at best, you know, if they're even considered. Most of these things that where all these pipelines are laid and stuff like that, these are traditional treaty lands that these people just go ahead and do their thing, and because they're big corporations and stuff, it's accepted by the general population, or they use that eminent domain thing. Eminent domain itself was supposedly for use by the government for the public benefit and not corporations. Corporations are now using eminent domain, which is questionable at best.
So that's the legal premise they've used to like put the pipeline through has been eminent domain.
Pretty much, yeah. And they call it it's necessary for the people, you know, and economically and all that, you know, baloney. It's just another ripoff or an abuse, I should say, another abuse of Native people and our wishes or our well-being, you know, our very existence. You know, when that pipeline ruptures, it's going to be a disaster for the Native people, but not just us, for everybody who drinks water along that system, millions of people, you know, and it's a threat forever until they remove it or stop it or, you know, get rid of it somehow. And that's one thing that, you know, America in general has to realize, is that we're going to have to get rid of these fossil fuels, you know, leave it in the ground. It's not worth it. You know, it's not worth killing the planet to drive your car across town. Really, to be sustainable, you have to look again to the seventh generation. And we have to look to the future of the seventh generation coming down. What kind of world are we going to leave them? You know, as our grandfathers left for us, and now we're going to screw it up, you know. Seven generations ago, our people were thinking forward, and they were thinking for the good of the people. You know, we were the first ecologists. You know, we realized what a treasure it is to live here, and how blessed we are to be here. You know, every day we say a prayer when we get up, thank you. You know, thank you for letting me be here. You know, because we're just weak and humble. But somehow in this generation, we've taken it, the majority society, I should say, has taken it upon themselves to ruin it for the seventh generation. And that's just against everything we believe as Lakota people. You know, so There it is. I don't know. I can't speak for all Lakota. We were speaking about that on the way in today, you know, because there are people who, you know, Indian people who are opposing us, you know, as water
people. Who are in favor of the pipeline.
Who are in favor of the pipeline, you know.
And why is that? I mean, what
status quo. You know, this lady that I was quoting from this morning, she lives in government housing, you know, and I don't know what she does for a living, but it's probably dependent on, you know, something like that, you know. And a lot of the people, a lot of Native people have a financial stake in their opposition to...
What, they have stock in oil companies?
No, not necessarily. No, I doubt that. You know, we are not known for having, being stock, you know. But yeah, just their jobs, you know, the jobs and their...
Well, now what kind of jobs are going to be provided by this pipeline? I mean, after the construction is finished.
Nobody. See, and that's a big fallacy that the corporation uses, is all the jobs that it's going to create. But it's not going to create anything for the Native people. You know, her thing is that she needs the gas to get to work and get to town, and that's what the pipeline's going to provide, which is not true. You know, most of these things are going overseas to fuel China. And it's a Canadian corporation who's profiting. They hire these crews who are on the pipeline construction, and when they are done with construction, those jobs go away. You know, and then that pipeline just lays there. So, there's no job there. They're going to have plenty of jobs when it ruptures and they have to clean up, of course. Maybe that's what they're looking forward to. I don't know. I don't understand the thinking myself.
So you two have just returned from Standing Rock quite recently. And how long were you out there?
I think we were out there about 12 days.
So can you describe what the scene was like out there?
I never went to the front line. Gary did. But the scene in camp, I can describe that a bit.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about it.
It's just a well-organized group of really passionate, awesome people. I mean, again, it's like there isn't even, I can't think of the proper words to say how amazing this is.
What is the case? Is it like a bunch of people brought their own tents and it's like...
There's tents and teepees. A lot of yurts are being given for the winter. Mongolian yurts are being donated. I know a few people that are actually buying some, and then when they leave there and they're done using them, they'll leave them for other people. People are living in their cars. But there's camps where you can go and get food. There's fresh water everywhere so you can wash up. There's a lot of toilet facilities, the porta pots. It's really well organized and real taken care of and very clean. And man, it's so cool to see. You know, you can walk through a group of 1,200 people and not see garbage all over the ground. I think the whole time I was out there, I might have seen 2 cigarette butts on the ground. And it was ironic because at the sacred fire, one of the speakers was saying, pick up your butts. You know, and I saw only 2, whereas if I walk out my door in my shop, there's cigarette butts all over the street. So, I mean...
So who's handling the logistics? I mean, who organizes all this? This takes quite a bit of thinking.
The people. And people come from all over the world and step in when somebody leaves. They might, like myself, I worked in the donation tents, and I was only there for a couple of days and worked one day all day. But as one person leaves, another person comes in. And the last day I was working in donations, I saw 3 people that just came to camp and came up and said, what can I do? Mm-hmm. And there's a main donation camp, and then everything goes there, and then it gets filtered over you, whether it's food or clothing or medical supplies. I saw car batteries and just about anything you could think of. I mean, people just donate anything they can think of that might be useful. And right now what people need there are goods for a North Dakota winter. So if people are thinking about donating clothes, please don't send anything that is not down or super, super warm. It seemed like they had plenty of the hats and gloves thing covered, but coveralls, like quilted coveralls, and good warm winter coats.
Bedding?
That's pretty well covered.
So you see, people are coming from all around the world. Are people coming from all around the world sort of equipped to take care of themselves with their tents and so on, or are people like coming and needing support?
Right now, they are just calling for people. Right now, because things are heating up, they just want people to come. It doesn't matter. The spokesman that I heard said, don't even bother bringing anything, just yourself. Just come. They need people. Everything else will be taken care of. You know, that's how you roll when you are people. You know, you operate through faith. You know, you have faith and things happen. You know, and it's a movement without a leader. You know, you asked who was in charge and blah, blah, blah. There might be different spokespeople or more people that are more knowledgeable that you would go ask about certain things around camp, but there's really no leader. You know,
you were there, actually, when there was a lawsuit to try and stop the pipeline from going through, and you were actually there when that was turned down in court, right?
Columbus Day. You know, what they call Columbus Day. We call Indigenous Peoples Day. That morning they announced, that they were going to go ahead and resume drilling. So there was a mobilization at camp, and people started getting ready to fulfill those kind of roles, you know, that need to be the opposition roles and stuff. And again, it's not anything violent, you know, not calling all the big tough guys to get up there and beat heads, you know. It's we need, you know, grab your sage, grab your sweetgrass, grab your, you know, eagle feathers and bring your prayers and let's go. You know, it's about peace and outpraying them and outlasting them. You know, there's a big realization there that we can't fight the military. You know, there's a lot of vets involved here, and they, you know, we know what we're up against. You know, you can't really win militarily. So prayer and hope, and hopefully people's hearts will be changed. Five now confirmed of the state troopers have quit their jobs, and one has joined the camp, and the other four have just quit because they said it's unethical and immoral to do what they're doing. They're protecting a corporation over these peaceful, prayerful people who are, you know, constitutionally upholding their rights and bringing these things to the surface, and they're being met with military force.
You know, a great deal has been made about the Keystone Pipeline, and actually resistance to that was, I think, key to President Obama eventually deciding that he was going to oppose it. Why is this other pipeline going in that does much the same thing with so little public review?
I think they're a little sneakier. You know, they got a lot more done behind the scenes before it came to light. They're using a little bit. See, they learn. Every time they're defeated, they learn. And what got them defeated, they try to take steps to prevent that. What they've done this time is, instead of applying for, because as a whole, they will need an EPA permit for the whole project. So what they're doing is doing little sections that don't require any kind of EPA guidelines. And so they're slipping under the radar that way. So we have no idea of the safety, you know, because they're non-regulated. And just little things like that, you know, they learn. And now, and one of the things that they found through history, you know, is that if you tie us up in court, you know, we are a minority and there's not a lot of us. And so it hurts, you know, if we get all locked up in jail and stuff. But there are, you know, still, when you get out, you go back. When you get out, you go back. When you get out, you go back. You know, that's the way we do it.
I know that there's actually quite a support community locally. Tell me a little bit. I know that there's some events coming up.
Yes. This weekend, we're having a Standing Rock rally from the ferry terminal down to the Port Marine building. And on that day, there are going to be worldwide demonstrations and things like that. So Saturday the 5th is not just Port Townsend, but all over the world. We are standing up and standing with Standing Rock. But in Port Townsend, there's a very strong support group here, and I'm really proud of them. They really come together. People are going to the camp back and forth now. You know, right now it's a game of attrition. You know, they rounded up over 100 last Saturday, and now they're starting to warehouse them in the Fargo. I don't know what county jail that is, but that again is another hardship because you got to get back from Fargo back up towards Bismarck again across the state. Again, it's a matter of obstruction and attrition. You know, that's what they do, you know, because again, they have unlimited manpower and funds. So, but they seriously misunderestimate us because that doesn't really matter, you know, because this in the camp is such a sense of freedom and prayer and hope. You know, it's just really makes your heart feel good to see all that, you know, all our people standing up together and standing strong and not afraid.
Watch any of the video that's coming straight out of the front line. It's really amazing when the people, the protectors, are talking to these people and saying, you know, this just isn't just for the Native people. This is for your water, for your family, for your children. We pray for you. You know, we believe in you. It's just a job. You're getting a paycheck. But this isn't right, and you know this isn't right. I mean, go look at your mothers. Go look at your daughters and tell them you want, you know, like, you want to protect a big corporation instead of the people. You were hired to protect and serve the people, not corporation.
In addition to the March for Standing Rock, starting at Port Townsend Ferry Terminal at 1 o'clock on Saturday and ending with a rally at Pope Marine Park, there will be a benefit concert for Standing Rock at the Roadhouse, Friday evening, November 4th, starting at 7 p.m., featuring Crush Proof Juice Box, Lefty and the STK, Knothead, Bobby Nolan, Jordy Sam, Endgame, and DJ Jopa. Then on Saturday, November 12th, a benefit variety show performance for Standing Rock will be held from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Palindrome, featuring numerous renowned local artists including Abacus, Welcome McQuillan, the incredible homegrown juggling theater group Nanda, mandolist extraordinaire Matt Cercely, and at least one member of the revered Flying Karamazov Brothers. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass.
Growth is usually incremental, with new facilities and businesses opening year-round and eventually adding up to a more robust community. Last week, Port Townsend saw its own immediate growth spurt with the opening of new additions to both Jefferson Healthcare Hospital and Peninsula College. On September 23rd, Jefferson Healthcare opened its new $20 million, 50,000 square foot emergency services building, drawing about 500 people for tours, information, and snacks. The following day, Peninsula College formally opened its $6 million, 14,000 square foot facility, drawing a smaller crowd of about 150. The attendance differences had mostly to do with the respective scope of the projects, but also reflected the weather. The hospital opened on a sunny Sunday, while the college had to deal with wind, cold, and a little rain. Congressman Derek Kilmer, who attended the hospital opening, said the new facilities have a significant economic impact.
I think it's exciting from a few perspectives. First, just as significant employers in and of themselves. You know, this is a facility that's going to employ a whole lot of people, same thing with the college. But secondly, they attract more people, more employers to come to this area. You know, it's an important building block of your economy to have top-notch healthcare facilities, top-notch educational facilities, and I'm really excited about what's happening here in Port Townsend.
Jefferson County District 2 Commissioner David Sullivan feels that one and one, in this case, adds up to more than two.
Well, I think education is a part of the answer to every problem, and so I really think the collaborative effort out at Building 202 is going to really help everybody. And healthcare is essential, and especially as we change our model to healthy communities, this is going to be a place where we focus on that and work with public health and do a collaborative venture.
Both projects were conceived in 2011, but it took until May 2015 to break ground. Both had a September 2016 target date, and both had minor delays that postponed the opening until last week. The hospital's new emergency and specialty services building will host a new emergency room, medical short-stay areas, including cancer treatment units, and more space for specialty clinicians. The building includes a brand new emergency room, a more easily accessed main entrance, rehabilitation services, respiratory care, and chemotherapy stations that boast a view of the bay. Hospital CEO Mike Glenn said that construction completion is just the beginning.
Well, now that the party's over, the challenge is to move in and begin to develop new patient flows and make sure that we can incorporate the same quality of care that we were providing in the old space into the new space. And while there are lots of advantages to the new space, it's new. And it'll take a while for our employees to get accustomed to the new care environment. We think that's a pretty low hurdle to get over compared to the challenges associated with working in old and tired space.
Glenn said the new facilities represent community growth.
Well, I think it's uplifting, it's just two of many exciting things that are going on. The new Grant Street Elementary School project is moving forward. I think there's some exciting things going on with a potential health and wellness facility in the community. So clearly, it's a community on the move, and it's fun to see all of the community partners collaborating.
The Port Townsend branch of Peninsula College includes four general classrooms, a science classroom, a studio art room, a learning lab, a workforce training room, a student study space, faculty offices, and a reception space. Video-equipped classrooms allow classes to be conducted in one location and viewed in another. This is superior to your run-of-the-mill web-based program. Part of higher education is a connection with other people, which remote classrooms allow and encourage. College President Luke Robbins expects the new facility to expand its curriculum.
In the community, are really interested in continuing education and community service types of classes. And some of the things we're already doing, you know, with lecture series and things like that are very popular. With younger folks, we're probably going to be looking at some more, you know, focused programs that help people get ready for a job. So information technology, maybe cybersecurity, things like that that younger folks are really interested in.
Robin said the college will create advisory groups to solicit input from the community as to what kind of programs would provide the greatest local benefit.
Care is going to continue to be a core business both for Port Townsend and also Port Angeles and even Forks. And so serving the needs of the healthcare industry is something that we're very interested in, you know, continuing to do. But I think it creates synergy in a community. And I think there are, frankly, some really good things going on right now in Port Townsend. I think there's some great things going on all across the Olympic Peninsula, Port Angeles, Forks, other places where we have the opportunity to really work together and collaborate.
At both events, many speakers and attendees attributed the successful completion of the facilities to collaborations. In the college case, the collaboration was between the City of Port Townsend, the Fort Worden Public Development Authority, and the state. At both functions, successful collaboration was cited as the path to future growth. Here's Port Townsend City Manager David Timmons.
You know, the attention comes down to that we build a partnership, and that partnership has produced a result. And I think that is the key lesson here that we can learn and we can pass on through the education system is you can't do it alone. You got to do it together. So you have to find ways to work together.
Timmons ended his remarks with a phrase often used during the process, slightly modified. Port Townsend is perceived as a college town without a college. That has now changed. When people visit a town after many years away, they notice all of the incremental changes at once. This isn't necessarily positive. Espanola, New Mexico, where I had my first newspaper job in the 1970s, now has a Walmart and a casino. Port Townsend, at the end of the road, can only grow so much. There will always be people who've been here for decades who whine about the good old days. But it's indisputable, improved health care and education options are a good thing. This is Charlie Burmant for KPTZ Compass.
Today's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans and Charlie Burmant. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.